This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new coronavirus subvariant is becoming more common in Wisconsin, but new case and hospitalization numbers around the state are the lowest they've been since last summer. We'll talk to an infectious disease expert about the latest news, and you can join in with your questions. Now, sometimes you've got hours to spend on making a meal. Maybe you track down special ingredients, get really gourmet with it. Other times, it's 6 o'clock, you need dinner, now-ish. That's when having a couple quick and simple recipes on standby can come in really handy. It's Food Friday. Our guest is here to share some of those quick dinner recipes with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the recipes you go to when you need dinner on the table fast? Is it a quick pasta dish, an easy salad? Have you found ways to save time cooking dinner? Do you do a lot of planning ahead? Maybe weekend time to get something ready for the weekdays? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is the creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of multiple cookbooks, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant, and Unfussy New Favorites. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back on.
Well, you've got a family, a job that keeps you hopping, Deb. I think we've all been in that position. When do you find yourself needing that quick dinner?
Almost every day when I forget that, despite having children for 12 years now, that they actually need to be fed, even if you already fed them that day or the night before.
I know.
It surprises me every day.
And, you know, in my head, I'm like, no problem. I'll always plan ahead and have something ready to rock or crock pot in the morning. But when it comes down to it, I'm just not that smart. So how do you overcome that situation? What are some of your first ideas that you go to when you're in that need it soon situation?
You know, I try to use it as like a last chance thing, because I try not to call it in more than once a week, but pasta is definitely something that I find very helpful. You know, it's always nice to have a couple shapes and sizes on hand and a couple things that you can make with it. I love doing this dish, this quick pasta and chickpeas. The recipe is on my site, but it is so easy to make. And I love it because you also throw in a can of chickpeas. So you feel like you're getting something a little more nuanced than just like boiled pasta with tomato. And it has a really quick sauce and it's kind of brothy, almost like a soup. And my kids actually eat it, which is always a small miracle. And I like the fact that I'm not just eating like a straight bowl of pasta every time I run out of ideas.
We've got that. That's one of the recipes Deb shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can check it out. Yeah, tell us a little more about what goes into this pasta with chickpeas. You got to boil the pasta. That's pretty quick. We're using canned chickpeas here, I imagine, because otherwise it takes a much longer time.
So you actually do not need to boil the pasta. And that is one of my
favorite
parts.
I read this one.
It's so cool. I love this. And I just wish more recipes would build this in. I mean, I don't think that all like cooking pasta in the sauce gets a great texture, but since we're going for something kind of brothy here, it works great. So what you do is you start, and it's such a short ingredient list too. I hope you can see, but you start with some olive oil, and then you're going to cook 2 cloves of garlic, and you're going to get some nice color on them because we want some real deep flavor. Then we're going to add tomato paste. We're going to have 3 tablespoons. And what you do is you're going to really cook this a little bit, so it's like a good shade or two darker. From there, you're going to add water. And this water is where you're going to cook your pasta. So you already have this garlicky tomato broth. You can put in red pepper flakes to taste. I like it kind of spicy, but I'm not feeding. Not everyone I feed agrees. So from here, you add 1 can of drained chickpeas, and then you just add half a cup of a small dried pasta, and you cook them together. And in this time that the pasta cooks, the chickpeas soften and it all comes together. So it really is just such a quick meal because you get to cook the pasta right in it. And I have this sort of finishing oil you can make with herbs and garlic if you want to make it taste like a little fancier. That also keeps it vegan, but Parmesan on top works as well, too. Yeah,
that's right. I remember when I read this recipe, it struck me. I can't think of other recipes where I cooked pasta in the sauce. You know, I usually cook it separately and then add everything together.
And I like to, just because it's sort of fun. I was never allowed to have SpaghettiOs growing up. I'm not sure why. When I get off the phone, I'm going to call my parents and ask them. But I never had SpaghettiOs growing up. So I was always like a little jealous of friends who did. So I love keeping that little ring shape around of dried pasta. Plus, this only uses half a cup at a time. So you'll have more left if you buy a bag. And I love the way it makes this dish look like SpaghettiOs, but like for grown-ups.
We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator of Smitten Kitchen, the cooking site, and author of cookbooks under the Smitten Kitchen label. She is helping us cook dinner on the clock. When you got to have something on the table soon for yourself, for family, for friends, join in if you have a question or a favorite go-to in that scenario. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb, you mentioned you like keeping the ring-shaped pasta around. What are some other key ingredients that you just always like to have around for that need it now kind of situation?
I feel like tomato paste is a really useful thing to have. I'm going to assume that we all have like an onion and some garlic around, but if you don't, just go buy an extra one every time you're at a store, and then you just obviously use the oldest one first. I think a good block of Parmesan or Pecorino is really useful to have. It just, I feel like it sharpens up dishes really quickly. I always like to have a lemon, or three. And I mean, I'm going to assume you have oil and vinegar and stuff like that, but I feel like those things. And also, I love to have either both frozen, just a box of it, and also just a bag of fresh spinach. I feel like these are really helpful ways to turn a kind of basic pantry scrounged together meal into something that feels a little more nutritious.
Now, not all of your recipes are quick. That's not the only kind of thing you cook.
Of course
What
not. Mm.
does it take, though, when you're developing a recipe for it to get the quick label? What's the timeline? What's the cutoff date for you?
I'm looking at, for me to call something quick, I'm looking at usually around 30 minutes, but like I'm thinking 45 minutes tops. And I mean 45 minutes with pulling the stuff out of the fridge, like with the chopping, with everything. I need to know that I could have like kind of forgotten that I needed to make dinner again and we want to eat at 6, and I started it at like 5:20 and I was not sweating at 6 and we were eating it. So I'm looking for it to be without an insane amount of rushing, for it to be really truly done and for it to taste good and not like a giant compromise.
That is exactly the timeline I used to cook on when my kids needed to eat, earlier because they went to bed earlier. And I got home from this show, like literally the 5:20 to 6 was. And so I would be picturing on the bus ride home, like every step,
What
like
can I
go in,
make?
turn on oven, get this out of the fridge. Then I can put the backpack down. Don't even, yeah. Do
Yeah,
you
just
have
get the
that, like,
water
sort of like,
boiling before you've done anything. But
exactly.
it's but I'm not going to lie to myself either. Like if it did not get done in 30 to 45 minutes tops, I'm not going to call it quick because then I'm just lying to myself, because when I'm going to my site to look for a quick recipe, I don't want to be misled either. So these were things that I've made and they really truly get done quickly.
Now here's another quick one. This is another pasta one. It's a mac and cheese, and I love this because you can find lots of fancy mac and cheeses, and you do some, but this is more in the boxed mac and cheese experience, which you're a fan of.
I am a great fan of it. I think powdered cheese is a beautiful invention. That said, I find this to be as quick to make as boxed mac and cheese. Like the only thing that takes like 1 minute longer, and we're talking one, and that's if you don't buy it pre-grated, is grating some Parmesan. But I think anybody who's a parent or anybody who craves macaroni and cheese at some point has wished that they had a go-to easy stovetop recipe that didn't require you to have three different types of cheese in the fridge, because I don't. And you could just make use of what you had. And so I started making it with Parmesan cheese, just Parmesan. Or if I have a sharp white cheddar, which is usually like a second cheese I would keep around if I'm looking for a second one, I'll use half and half. But I find that these two white sharp cheeses add a lot of impact and like that kind of boom of flavor you're looking for and that salty impact without needing a lot of cheese. And so I started making my sort of quick, that's sort of my actually quick stovetop mac and cheese with it. And it's become an immediate staple. It is absolutely the thing I make if I am either just cooking for the kids, craving it myself, or maybe we're going out and babysitter's coming and I don't want to order food. So it gets made probably twice a month in my household.
Now, suppose you're a stereotypical Wisconsinite, and three kinds of cheese is kind of the minimum you might have in the
Oh my
fridge.
God,
What
I'm
would be
living in
your
the wrong
favorite?
state.
What would be your favorite combo of cheeses to put on this quick mac and cheese?
My favorite combo, I would probably do Parmesan. I would either do Parmesan or Pecorino. And I would do some sharp white cheddar. I feel like 50-50 with a sharp white cheddar and pecorino and parmesan has a really nice impact. If you're looking for more of like a nutty, full-bodied, I don't know, fancy taste, I would add a little Gruyere, Comté, or baby Swiss, like whatever you can get more easily with for a slight nuttiness. But I think that you can get a shockingly pleasant amount of flavor from the parmesan and the white cheddar.
It is Food Friday. We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's with us today to talk about dinner recipes for when you're crunched for time but still want something yummy that the other people eating will also find yummy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you now, or you in the past? Well, you're not cooking dinner yet, or maybe you are. I don't know. What is your favorite go-to when you need something on the table fast? Do you have a secret ingredient that you have to make that quick-made thing a little bit better? Are you too busy to share with us right now? Take just a minute. It won't take too long. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And don't forget, pick up a few recipes from Deb over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation about fast and easy dinners for those times you don't have the time or energy for much else. Deb Perlman with Smitten Kitchen is with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have those moments where you got to get something turned around fast? What do you turn to get dinner on the table quickly? Do you need some advice from Deb? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Colleen joins us now in Viroqua. Colleen, hi.
Hi there. I'm excited to be on the show. My daughters found the Smitten Kitchen website years ago, and we use several of her recipes regularly, so thank you, Deb. Chewy oatmeal cookies. I think it's one that comes to mind that we make. But if there's a recipe we're searching for and we see that you have a version of it, we go there. But my kids are grown and gone now, and I just cook for my husband and I. And I've had a problem with Parmesan. If I'm making a cheese sauce for pasta, like maybe an Alfredo, and I'm making it from scratch, the Parmesan clumps up in the pan. So I'm wondering if you have any tips for that.
Colleen, before I let you go, can I ask, are you using pre-shredded or pre-grated Parmesan, or are you grating it yourself?
I'm grating it myself.
Oh, okay. Well, that kills my answer, Colleen. Thanks. Deb, do you have any advice for Colleen?
I think there's two pieces. So first of all, I mean, I think that I always add cheese to a sauce at the very last. Like when I make my stovetop macaroni and cheese, I make this quick bechamel. I turn the heat off and remove it. And then I add the cheese because there's enough warmth in there to melt the cheese without it kind of melting too much and then splitting. And then you've got like that wicking out of the oil and probably more of a clumpy texture from the curd that's left behind. So that's the first thing, is I always add the cheese at the very last of the sauce. I think it's okay to do it on the heat, but I would do it last. The second part is, I find it can be helpful if the sauce wants you to cook it for a while, and this may not, you know, I don't know which Alfredo recipe you're using, but for the cacio e pepe on my site, a trick I learned from this wonderful Roman cooking teacher named Elizabeth Mancilli, and she learned it from a restaurant in Rome. But the restaurateur, he starts with, instead of using hot pasta water for his cacio e pepe, he starts with cold water. And it sounds crazy, but he blends the cheese into that, and then he heats that. And it keeps the cheese from kind of melting and clumping, because you're not going to melt it and then warm it again, if that makes sense. So if you just think of it, cheese as having kind of one chance to melt well before it gets clumpy and separated, you know, just think of maybe adding the cheese a little bit later or adding it to a cooler point in the sauce.
All right, Colleen, couple things you could try there. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. All right, Deb, we got a third recipe you shared with us. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday, another Smitten Kitchen favorite. Now, this one, I'm really interested in this. It's a simple chicken tortilla soup. Now, I got a sister-in-law from Mexico who makes an all-day cooking kind of a tortilla
soup.
Don't
show her this.
Yeah. I do one that's, you know, takes a while, but this one comes together really fast. I love tortilla soup. Could you tell us how this one comes together so quickly?
I definitely want to tell you about this one because it's a new recipe this week, except for the fact that I have been making it this way at home for years. I thought what was like every chicken tortilla soup out there. And a lot of them just kind of tasted, they were good to me, but they took a while. I didn't really like starting with canned whole tomatoes. I didn't love the texture. When I've had it in Mexico, I remember there being more of a smooth, spicy tomato broth. And I wanted to make it that way. And when I did, I sort of accidentally realized that it was very quick to make soup this way. So what I do is I start with some chopped onion, jalapeno, and garlic. And we cook it together, you know, as you would when you start almost anything until it's a little bit brown. Then we add some cumin and chili powder. I use the mild one because I'm cooking for kids. Cook that in for a minute. Then we add tomato paste. This shows up again like it did in the pasta and chickpeas. And we add a quarter cup of it. And this really makes the entire soup a tomato soup. We cook that for a minute. And from here, we add the chicken broth and the chicken. And we cook the chicken thighs right in this broth. I'm using boneless, skinless. So it takes just like really just about 15 minutes, not 1 minute more for the cutlets. Pull them out, shred them. And while you shred them, you heat up some beans. And if you want, you can add some corn to it too. Add the chicken back. And I'm telling you, that I told you about the 5:20 thing, like I could probably start this at 5:35 and we could eat it at 6 o'clock.
Wow.
It's incredible. It's so great. And it's full of flavor. At the end, you absolutely, like, it is not negotiable. You have to finish it with lime juice. I feel like it lifts the whole thing. And then if I have time, we either do crumbled tortilla chips, or I explained to you how to quickly make some fried tortilla strips. We'll finish it with avocado if we had it, some cilantro. And then if you have, I love putting some cotija cheese on it, on that crumbled, sharp, kind of funky Mexican cheese. And I'm telling you, it is the easiest recipe. Everyone eats it. You know, the younger ones act like it's sort of like a taco soup, which it kind of is, you know, dipping chips in. And I don't know, I feel like it's going over really well. And I feel like I should have shared it a long time ago because it's become a really important part of our tired of cooking but want to eat something good arsenal.
That sounds fantastic. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jen is with us in Manitowoc. Jen, hi.
Hi, and hi, Deb. I love your Instagram, and I've been following you forever. You're welcome. What I love, which we ate like multiple times a week this summer, was the zucchini, which barely hits olive oil, and then it has almonds and parm. That's your recipe. I know you said it was from a restaurant.
I love that dish. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're
Jen?
Welcome. And I also make your slice and bake cookies all the time.
Cool. And Jen, are you looking forward to zucchini season this year?
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
That recipe is from the old, I mean, it's not the way they make it because they make it more complicated, but it's from this recipe. There's a restaurant that was in Chelsea for many, many years called the Red Cat. And it's a quick zucchini saute. And you literally cook the zucchini in 2 minutes. You don't want to cook it longer. And it's just Parmesan and salt and pepper and some toasted almonds that you fried in olive oil. And it is like I could eat a mile of it. It's so good in zucchini season.
Fantastic. Jen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We've had a couple mention your cookies. Now, obviously, you know, we're not necessarily hurrying to make those for dinner, except sometimes.
No, of course
but,
not.
Do you have favorite quick cookies or other desserts where you're like, I need something for company or whatever?
For that, and since I'm usually making it at home and it's often a weeknight and we just need a little something, there is a whole wheat chocolate oat cookie on the site that is really quick to make. It is whole wheat. I swear it is. The whole wheat is not there for nutritional aspirations. It was like over the pandemic, I realized that I liked my oatmeal cookies better with whole wheat. They're a little airier. They've got a little more texture to them and they have this they just taste nuttier and more wonderful. So I started making these cookies over the pandemic as one does with the ingredients I had around chocolate, oats, and a whole wheat flour only. And I love them. I mean, I have cookie recipes where you have to make the dough and cook it the next day, but I do not believe that is in the nature of cookies. And
Yeah.
the nature of cookies is I want a cookie and I want to put it in the oven right away. And it's one of those. It makes 12 3-inch cookies, which are a nice size. They can try asking for seconds, but I think after a 3-inch cookie, we're all happy. And it makes a dozen, and it's really done in 20 minutes, including the baking time. So I love it.
Our caller mentioned your Instagram, and our producer pointed out something you have called real life menus on your Instagram, as opposed to what people might see on your site. I assume there's some overlap. What do you think about with a real life menu?
Yeah, I'm not trying to mislead people with the site. The site is still my cooking. But if we were
Right.
talking about, am I going to cook something aspirational from the site 7 days a week? Oh my goodness, no. And I have never tried to pretend otherwise. But I have this menu board I keep on the fridge, and it is less planning because I'm not a very good planner, and a little more of just a rundown of what we ate on Monday and Tuesday. And I started sharing them, and I guess people like to see what you really eat. And sometimes it's a recipe from the site, sometimes it's something new I'm working on, and sometimes it's one of these things I've mentioned where I am just tired and I'm not feeling it, and we threw something together. And people, I mean, it's, I think we need to hear about this too. There's also like takeout, and like there's been at least one night in the last month where there was peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner because nobody was feeling it. But for the most part, I think it's what's real about it is that it's a mix of real cooking and just the cooking that you do because you ran out of time and this is what you had.
Well, you know what I love about this is, you know, sometimes when my kids were, you know, around and I was cooking for them, I would definitely have those moments of guilt on those quick, you know, throw something together meals. Sounds like you're helping us take the guilt out of this a little bit, Deb.
I think you should take all of the guilt out of it. In fact, I think you should lean right into it. I think you should embrace it. And then once you've given yourself a break from the guilt and the cooking, you know, the heavy cooking, maybe you'll get your urge to cook back. Maybe you'll feel more inspired because you weren't giving yourself a hard time. So I more encourage people to be gentle with themselves. Sometimes it's been a long day. I don't think our kids are suffering if they eat once every 3 months a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or even more. For like, this is not the great crime of their generation. So I just think that lean into it. And then when you've given yourself a break on that night, you might have time and energy the next time to start making something you care about more.
Deb, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of a bunch of cookbooks, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day. She was with us today to share some quick dinner recipes and advice. Find some of her recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. The last remaining mask mandates in Wisconsin have expired, and numbers of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths related to COVID-19 are way down, about where they were last summer. Lots of good news. On a possible downside, we're seeing the emergence of a new subvariant of the Omicron version of the coronavirus here in the state. But how worried should we be about it? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the latest coronavirus trends, about the new subvariant? What has life been like for you in a post-mask mandate world? How do you feel about the way things look and seem right now? And do you have kids in schools, kids unvaccinatable, like under the age of 6 right now? What are you seeing out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Daniel Shirley is assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Shirley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the latest numbers we're seeing here in Wisconsin and around the country, a decline since that Omicron-related peak?
Yeah, fairly universally throughout the United States and Wisconsin, cases went down pretty rapidly. And then that was followed by a decrease in hospitalizations and death, as you mentioned. And that's really the big positive here is that, you know, all that was reflected in less people in the hospital really sick with COVID.
What led to this? Was it just that Omicron peak kind of burning itself out as these waves seem to do?
A little bit. I think it's a kind of a combination of things. You know, there was good vaccination in our state with some, you know, boosting. And then, like you said, a huge surge of Omicron. And those two things together, along with some people who got vaccinated that also got infected, did create kind of a situation where there was some protection against further infection and cases went down.
Now, I don't want to start spiking footballs here yet. We've had good stretches before, only to have a new variant or whatever come back. What are some, before we get into this new sub-variant of Omicron in particular, what are some of the concerns you have looking toward the future?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the good news is cases went down, hospitalizations went down, but the things we don't really know are how long the protection lasts. It seems like we've hit a time in the world where this worked pretty well, but we don't know the protection from vaccination or infection with Omicron, how long that's going to kind of be a wall of against future protection or against future infection. So I think another good thing is that we're going into a season where the weather is nicer, so people can get out and just be less close to other people that could be infected. So I think we're in a mode of close monitoring at this point, which is good that we can do that.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Shirley, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest COVID-related news, numbers, and trends. And you can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dr. Shirley, we have this new now sub-variant of the Omicron variant. I imagine a sub-variant is less distinct from what we had seen before in Omicron. What do we know about this sub-variant?
Yeah, so there's a lot of letters and numbers involved, but yes. All of the Omicron variants have sort of a sub-variant. So, in this case, the new one is BA.2, and that's what's causing a lot of cases and a rise in those cases in Europe and Asia right now. We have this sub-variant in the United States and in Wisconsin also, and it actually is replacing the previous variant of Omicron. But the good thing is that that so far hasn't increased the case level here in Wisconsin. So it's just kind of replacing the cases we do have with a new sub-variant. But of course, we're watching super closely because it has resulted in increased cases in other places.
One hope I had seen, and I don't know if there's enough data to back it up yet, was that because Omicron affected a lot of people here and this new subvariant might be pretty similar to that, an infection with a previous Omicron variant might give more protection than, say, other variants of COVID-19. Does that make sense to you anyway?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the running theory. And similarly with the vaccination, that, you know, that protection hasn't really changed if you change the Omicron subvariant. And so that's why I think we have lower cases. But as I mentioned before, we aren't exactly sure how long that lasts. So there's still some monitoring to do and you know, basic precautions still, because there are cases still around.
Let's talk about vaccines a little bit. I've seen some of the vaccine makers looking at fourth doses, but not generally calling for them for the general public, mostly for people with immune system problems that make them not react as well initially, not get as much of a response for immunity from the 2+1 booster that a lot of people have. What are you looking at when it comes to who might need an extra dose?
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, this is a really important point, that there are people, a significant number of people who have an immunocompromising condition. And, you know, we were just talking about the case rates are low, but the risk, if you are immunosuppressed, of getting Omicron or this subvariant or whatever, is really high. I mean, they could still get very sick. And the vaccine for those individuals didn't work as well. They don't build antibodies in the same way. And so one way to sort of boost them is to give them an extra dose. And so far, that is really the only population that we have rolled that out in the United States. Other countries, they have done some studies to show that, you know, it does result in boosted antibodies in some populations. And that might be important for people over 65, for instance. There was a study, I think, with Moderna also kind of submitting the approval request. There'll be a lot more data upcoming about, you know, who should consider getting a fourth shot and when is the best time to do that.
What do you see as the biggest vaccination priority right now?
I think getting the data to make sure that it still stays protective against severe disease and hospitalization, because in the end, that is actually the major point of a vaccine, is to not make it where people get super sick and ended up in the hospital. As we know from the previous surges, if a lot of people get sick at the same time, it causes a lot of problems for the healthcare system.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. As far as subvariants and other and full variants or whatever taking over, I've heard it in the past about variants outcompeting each other. I just wonder, does that really happen? And what does it really mean when a variant outcompetes another? I'll hang up and listen.
Interesting question, Dennis. Thanks. Dr. Shirley, how do viruses outcompete their peers?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, we kind of envision them competing, like fighting it out, but it's more just the natural way of things. They're, you know, viruses are always mutating, and sometimes they get mutations in places that make them more contagious or more dangerous. As we've seen with COVID, the original COVID wasn't as contagious, and it's sort of gotten sequentially more contagious as time has gone on. And so when that happens, it outcompetes because it, you know, it's just more likely to spread, and therefore it overtakes the other versions. I think, you know, people sort of debate whether that increase in contagiousness then decreases the severity, but that isn't inherently true. It could be either way. Luckily for Omicron, it seems like it has become slightly less severe, or at least has caused less severe disease across the board. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a severe case in some instances.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. We're talking to Dr. Daniel Shirley, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at the latest COVID data for Wisconsin and beyond, as well as questions of vaccines. Coming up, we'll look at vaccines for kids under six and the latest progress there and other pandemic updates. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you have children, have they been vaccinated? If you have children under six, are you hoping that some kind of vaccine is successful and gets approved for that age group? Are you still taking precautions out in public, or are they on the shelf for now? What would it take to lead you to go back to them? Are you worried that we're loosening up too fast, or are you happy with where we are? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Daniel Shirley, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at the new Omicron subvariant of the coronavirus and other pandemic-related news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, with your thoughts about the current state of COVID, what's on your mind. Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Louis is with us in Oconto. Louis, hi.
Yes, my question is, with all the home testing, are we undercounting the cases? Because I know that, like in Oconto and Outagamie County, their health department doesn't want to know if you test positive or not. So actually, are the numbers higher than what is being published out there?
Oh, interesting. Louis, thanks for the call. Dr. Shirley, if we're testing ourselves at home and not calling it into a public health agency, are we missing some case counts? And if so, does it matter?
Yeah, it's a good question. We probably are missing a few, but some of the things that we watch to make sure we have a good count of cases is, you know, before you're admitted to the hospital, we do testing in many places. Before procedures, we're still doing testing in asymptomatic people. And then, of course, there are still people going to the testing centers and getting PCR testing. The other point about this is a number that people have been watching all along, which is the percent of tests that are positive. So even if you decrease the total number of tests, we can watch that percent positive. And all of that makes us think that people still are getting tested and that the rates are what they say they are at this point. This does bring up another big point, though, that home testing is great and it has its benefits, which is it's, you know, readily available. It's fast, accurate. It keeps people at home when they're sick and they don't have to go to a place to get tested. but it doesn't allow us to test for the variants to do the sequencing. Mm-hmm. So there still is a place to have these centralized testing with PCR. The other important part about testing right now is that it is important to test if you feel sick. So if you're sick, stay home, get a test, even if it's a home test, and then report that to someone, usually your doctor, because now, because cases are lower, we have more treatment available than we did when cases were so high. And so if you're a person with a medical condition or you don't know, it's worth discussing with your doctor to see if you qualify for treatment.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Francesca joins us now in Elkhorn. Francesca, hi.
Hi there. I still mask up when I go out into crowded indoor settings, and part of it is that I've had COVID a couple times. I know we watch wastewater treatment to find out what kind of caseload is going on out in reality, but what I really wanted to know was, how do we know what is causing long COVID and what percentage is long COVID happening with this new subvariant?
Francesca, thanks for the call. Long COVID, I think a lot of questions about that still, Dr. Shirley, and I'm guessing it may be too soon to tell with Omicron. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'd say that's accurate. Yeah, we just don't know. But even just knowing that it's possible, which definitely is possible, is a good point, because even if you have a mild case, you could end up with some of these long-lasting symptoms. And, of course, nobody wants that. So it's its own reason to try to avoid getting COVID in the first place. And, you know, it's sort of on the flip side, if you were someone who is worried about vaccination and potential side effects from that, we have a lot of data about that and the risk associated with it. Or lack thereof. And we do know that this long COVID, or even just if you didn't qualify as that, just symptoms that last longer than you would expect from a normal respiratory virus, that definitely occurs.
Francesca, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Francesca mentioned, Dr. Shirley, that she still masks when she goes to, you know, crowded public places. You know, mask mandates are gone pretty much everywhere now. Do you have thoughts on whether people should think about wearing them, or if something might happen in the future, what are the benchmarks you'd watch for to suggest that people wear them?
I think that the CDC, when they changed their guidance a little bit about the rates or the thresholds, that is an attempt to try to give some kind of marker of, you know, when your county or local area is reaching a dangerous level of COVID in the community. My personal kind of thought about this is a little bit what was said, you know, in places that are higher risk, and most of that has to do with not exactly knowing what you're getting into, is about how spaced out people are, how many people will be there, who's going to be masked or not, how the ventilation is in that space. Those kind of spots are still definitely some place to consider still masking. I think if you had medical conditions, especially immunocompromised, you should consider masking when you're around other people. And then there's this just kind of general rule that everyone should consider, you know, I'm going to go out. This is something that could be spread with minimal or no symptoms. And I still feel like I want to protect people around me. If there's any chance I have COVID, I don't want to give it to someone who could be super vulnerable.
Talking about the latest COVID-related news with infectious disease expert Dr. Daniel Shirley at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Still time for your question or thought at 800-642-1234. Dr. Shirley, we talked about vaccines, you know, who might need that fourth vaccine. Let's talk about the people who can't get the first one yet, kids under six. What are we watching for now when it comes to potential vaccines for five and under?
Well, I think we've gotten some news recently that, you know, Moderna is about to sort of ask for the initial approval. And then I think the question is, you know, who should get it and when, and all the data that we'll get from those studies will help us make that decision. I think a lot of parents right now over the last several weeks have dealt with this question for sure, and maybe even had a child that had COVID. And once that happens, it spreads pretty rapidly in families. And then, you know, it could travel towards vulnerable people and cause a problem.
So but for parents who are eager to get that vaccine, it sounds like maybe not going to happen in the next couple few weeks.
Yeah, but I think it's definitely a positive that it should be coming soon, the opportunity to do that. And, you know, anything that can kind of cut down the case rate, especially if cases start ticking back up, is going to be a benefit.
Now, one of our callers mentioned, and you've mentioned it as well, treatments for people who do have COVID. What is out there that seems to be working the best, that's the most promising now that we have in our toolkit that we didn't have at the outset of this whole thing?
Yeah, I think people have likely heard of oral antiviral therapies like Paxlovid, and there's another one. I think Paxlovid probably is the front runner for the first treatment that people would try to give you if you called in and you qualified. There's a little bit of sort of monitoring or at least checking of what other medications you're on to make sure there's not an interaction. But otherwise, it seems to be highly effective. And pretty easy to take. The trick is you have to start taking it within a certain amount of time of when you have symptoms. And so that's why, you know, if you have symptoms, get tested, and then you let somebody know in the right time, you might qualify for treatment. We still have monoclonal antibodies, and that's another big thing. There's more always coming down the pike. And so that's another route that your physician might help you get towards.
And now we're getting close to allergy season, with when a lot of us, myself included, will have lots of random symptoms. What are the key symptoms that someone might have that says, yeah, get that COVID test now?
I think the first thing to think as it relates to allergies is this exactly how my allergies are exactly at the same time every year? That will probably be the number one thing, because there is some crossover between some of the common COVID symptoms and allergies. I think the things that are more towards COVID are cough, shortness of breath, certainly fever. And then those things that everyone has heard by now, like loss of taste or smell, that's not necessarily kind of with allergies, at least as a, you know, thing that happens just rapidly. Basically, just watch. And if anything seems different than your usual allergies, I would consider COVID.
Let's bring on another caller now. Larry is with us in Madison. Larry, hi.
Hey, hi. My question is, if a person is fully vaccinated and then does get COVID, are there any documented cases of that person spreading COVID to someone else?
Interesting, Larry. Thanks. So fully vaccinated, you get COVID. In that instance, is it possible to spread the disease, Dr. Shirley?
It is. I think, you know, getting infected after a vaccination, that has been termed kind of a breakthrough infection. It's still contagious, but, you know, one, you are less likely to have been infected in the first place.
Right.
So that cuts down the risk in the broad terms. And secondly, there's some thought that your symptoms likely last less long, and therefore you have less of a chance to pass it along. But yes, there is a period with a breakthrough infection, especially with symptoms, that you could pass that along.
So if we are vaccinated and get it, quarantining ourselves for a little bit might still not be a bad idea.
Exactly. I would definitely say that, yeah, if you have symptoms, even if you're fully vaccinated and boosted, you should isolate and get a test again. This would hold true for kind of any prior infection, any vaccination status right now.
Dr. Shirley, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Daniel Shirley is assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to him today about a variety of pandemic-related news, including the Omicron subvariant of the virus and the prospect for vaccines for younger children and infants.